You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
My name is Tim Martin, the Executive Director of the Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. Thank you so much for joining today. It's such a beautiful day, and I really apologize for the weather having forced you guys in here. But today's the Internet Caucus Advisory Committee is touching the Internet in a long-term moratorium last. This is our fourth or fifth briefing on this issue in the 11-year history of the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. And the issue kind of ebbs and flows, but a lot of them thrown around. Back in 1997, when it was first introduced, Bartlett Clinton, our moderator for the debate, was around at that time when he was working for Senator Ashcroft. We are moderators today, and also my board of directors, so what we try to do is put together our panels in a fair and balanced manner and try to get them equitable. So Bartlett will do that job as a moderator. Bartlett currently works for the Institute for Policy Innovation in Texas. He also has worked for the Information Technology Association of America, and previous to that, he was with Americans for Tax Reform. Just one bit of housekeeping. It's a pretty busy week for us tomorrow on the Senate side. We have an event called Internet-Based Pharmacies Protecting Children from the Sale of Controlled Substances Online. If you're interested in that, that's the handout. The invitation is out there on the front, a little piece of paper. It's from 12 to 1. It'll be in the Dirksen's at Office Building, room 226, next week, next Wednesday. In the Raven Building, B338, the Raven Building. We're doing an event on patents, patent reform, and how it affects the internet and information communication technology space. So that's a good election as well. Raven Building, room B338. Also, my last housekeeping is what we do typically for most of our events is we collect one pagers from our advisory committee members, and we also reach out to folks who aren't on our advisory committee to the extent possible. So those are compiled. If you're perusing each one pager, should have contact information where you can follow up with the writer and get more information if you need to. So use that as a resource. If I introduce Bartlett Clinton, I'm to open us up. And thank you, Bartlett.
Yeah, I'm on the board, please. He's my boss. Thank you for coming today. I want to get you ready. A lot of people probably think I'm a free lunch card, but people open the source. You think it's free. Actually, you owe us something, and that is you owe questions at the end of the opening statements of the panelists. He's going to do about a 3 to 4 minute opening statement. So from now, plus my comments, you'll have about 20 minutes there to give your best questions. So it's not exactly free. Thank you for coming. Welcome. As Tim mentioned, this is actually a very old debate. Actually, not as old as some, but older than most people probably think. The very first time I heard of this issue was, I think, 1996, maybe 1997, when I was approached by any number of what we called then online service providers. Today, I guess it's called them communications. They deliver everything in the world to us. The parties were different. We had budding internet companies. We had shopping mall owners who were participating on panels like this. So if you can see just by the nature of the people on the panel, the debate has changed. What is interesting is that we went through two or three iterations, I'm lost track at this point. I've been involved on one side of this debate from one angle or another all along, including introduction of the legislation, with industry associations and with activist groups. The people have changed to this extent. We're right back to where we started. We're back to the communications folks and the government folks. One of the little pieces of history I'll highlight because it made a reference to it, at least it's important. There are some Supreme Court cases that speak to this issue, at least two. And there was also a government commission in 1999, was that? Advisory Commission on Electronic Commerce. I actually staff of the commission, I forgot what year we issued our report. It was 2000. Regardless, that report is still available online in various places and may or may not be illuminating to some of the topics here. So with that, let me get to the more contemporary debate. Introduce our four panelists. I'm going to introduce all four. If there's anything I missed out of your bios that you guys think are open, feel free to throw it out as the conversation goes on. First, I'll spell it over here, Roderick Johnson. And as I just mentioned him, I think of him as an AT&T guy. He actually has a varied career that I was not aware of, but a fabulous career. He is now president of Brian Cave Strategies and serves as counsel for Brian Cave, the law firm from my hometown, St. Louis, Missouri. From 2000 to 2006, he was a senior lobbyist at AT&T and Bell South, handling a plethora of telecom issues, beginning known as a tax guy over there. He spent 2.5 years doing various, I'll keep it short, 2.5 years doing various legislative affairs operations, not only in the White House, but then on presidential campaigns. He's here representing the Don't Tax Our Love Coalition, which is a, and I think this is possibly a sprawling coalition of people interested in one side of the debate, characterizes corporate, but not all. Next to him is David Quam, who is formed with the NJ. We actually met him at a business roundtable where he was under assault as just coming into the NJ and handled himself wonderfully over his side of the issue. And so I'm very confident in his performance here. He also, I just found out, was the predecessor running the subcommittee on the Constitution in the Solomon Senate Side Judiciary Committee, which is where Michael Moss took over after he left. Next to him is someone I almost respect, Brian Duran. I had a good friend for a long time, and I can basically skip his running history. He was the David Dreyer guy, and it was fabulous on the House side. It has been fabulous at eBay since then. I think I captured the stunning highlights of his career. I think actually, without reading this, we can actually run that. You run the DC based operation, right?
Well, that's broadly speaking, yes.
Very good. Last but not least, I'm not, I've run into before, but we just chatted today, Jeff Arnold, serves as the legislative director of the National Association of Counties. He has over 26 years' experience in D.C. working on and with Capitol Hill. He is NACO, Chief Lobbyist Center of Communications and Technology Policy, and is responsible for policy development on all issues. He used to work in the Senate. Actually, I'm from this panel. This is a bunch of Senate people, sorry. That was the gift. Finally, I'm going to say that our goal, all of us definitely read our goal, is to be as educational and illuminating as possible. If you have questions, again, please, I'm serious, ready to ask them because we really want to make sure that we don't walk out of here telling the experts in what's going on right now in this debate on Capitol Hill. With that, I'll just go down. If no one cares, I'll just go down the line here in order with opening statements. And so let's start with Brian.
Thank you. Folks, hear me? I need the microphone. I'm afraid you can hear me. I'll just yell because I'm a Wolverine, so we know how to yell pretty loudly, actually. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, by the way. When I first got engaged in this debate, I actually had more hair and a darker mustache, so that shows you how long this issue has been around. It would be good if 2 years from now, right, actually, after November 2nd, we had one of the panels to discuss the length of time for the moratorium that we could make it permanent, and that's what we're here to do. And I appreciate the topic, which is how long should the moratorium last? That's refreshing because previously we have debated and fought over whether or not there should be a moratorium at all. So it's an important message that we all share that there should be an extension of the moratorium. It's just a question of how long. You also keep in mind, it's very important to understand and remind yourself that this is about internet access. And it is not about whether or not there should be taxes on online sales. This is about access to the internet, whether or not that should be taxed. Just think about, here's a sort of a parallel that you should consider. What sense would it make as a matter of any tax policy, state, local, federal, if every time you went to a shopping mall, every time you went to a library, you had to pay a tax or a fee just to enter so that you could engage in commerce or you could gain knowledge about something. That's what we're really talking about here. Again, access. It has been recognized, again, for many years now, it's a matter of national policy. This goes back to the Clinton years, which is when the first moratorium was enacted. This is a bipartisan issue, by the way. There's nothing partisan about this issue at all. There's nothing ideological about this issue at all. The only ideological issue is whether or not we should tax access. And I think that's, again, the debate is over. It's just about how long this moratorium should be extended. But it's been recognized as a matter of national policy that we should not allow state and local governments to impose taxes on internet access or to impose multiple and discriminatory taxes on e-commerce. And we'll get into the subject of that a bit, I'm sure, as we have an exchange here. Why shouldn't we? Well, again, it's recognized as a matter of national policy that we want to spur the development of broadband make sure that people are actually taking broadband, adopting broadband. And while we have had much success in seeing broadband get deployed all over the nation, there are many, many millions of Americans who have not adopted broadband, and there are many Americans in lower income and rural communities who have not adopted broadband. That's where the issue of cost is therefore so important. So we don't want to talk about various studies, whether or not those studies are valid as to whether or not taxing internet access has an impact on whether or not people will actually adopt broadband. But to me, it's a matter of common sense. If you make something more expensive by imposing more taxes on it, you are going to depress the ability of people to take it or an interest in taking it. And we don't want to do that. We're not at the point where broadband should be seen as a luxury. It's a necessity. So how do we make sure the cost is low? Again, it's not a new debate. People have been agreeing now since 1998 that we want to keep the cost low and therefore not allow state and federal to do the same, state and local governments, to do the same thing they have done with communications in general. Look at your, I don't know if you all actually look at your phone bills anymore, but, you know, for us old timers, we're used to this big phone bill with all these pages that have all these taxes and all these fees imposed on them. And for a lot of people, it's just a confusing maze. We don't want to do that with internet access. That's such an important part of this debate. So let me go again to the point about how broad the support is for not taxing internet access. This issue has come up in the House of Representatives. I know it happened in 2003, and I believe it happened in 2001. There was so much support for the moratorium that the bill passed under suspension and without being a recorded vote, and it was a permanent moratorium on internet access that passed. When you look at the bill that's being considered this year, there are almost 100 co-sponsors on the bill that has Congresswoman Eshoo to Congressman Goodlatte as co-sponsors of the bill. I think I've been talking for 4 minutes, so you want me to move on? We'll go on and we'll talk about this further. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is David Kwan. I'm with the National Governors Association. I always appreciate the opportunity to debate this issue and the big project in particular. We've done this a couple of times now. We need to be clear about what we're talking about. And I also appreciate the title here, because the National Governors Association, to be clear, is calling for an extension of the moratorium. So this is not will we have it or will we not. It is literally about the time, but it's also about something else, and that is the definition. Exactly what is it that we're trying to extend, and does that need to be changed to make sure we got it right? When you look at the moratorium, we're using a 1998 definition to define the internet. Now, anybody here who was on the internet back in 1998, for most of us, there was two things. It was dial-up, and it was probably AOL. Maybe a few other providers. It was very limited. I don't think anybody would argue that the internet today is robust. This is a strong and growing economy, sector of the industry. And unlike it's sometimes portrayed, I will guarantee you I cannot find one governor who is against the internet. There is no governor who's against economic development, broadband deployment, or against propelling the internet and using all of the great things that it offers. But in 1998, when this idea came up, it was to spur a burgeoning industry, let's help get it off the ground, and let's do it in a way that recognizes the fact that this is the federal government trampling on state and local government taxation. This is a 10th Amendment issue. The right to put together your own tax systems. And at the end of the day, that was passed, and it was made temporary, in part to honor the fact that this is a federal government imposing a moratorium on the states and local governments. It's been extended. This time around, we have to get to the core issue, and that is, what is the definition of internet access, and what does it say, what does it mean? The old definition was written very broadly because no one knew how to define it. It said internet access is access, but then it also includes the ability to package other services with access, and the whole thing is subject to the moratorium. In the past, we haven't been able to change that troublesome definition. which I think is just too broad. We have a much better sense of what the internet is today. So the National Terrorist Association is calling on Congress to extend the moratorium, but do it in a way that does three things. Be clear, because definitions matter. It's time to get the definition of internet access correct. Be flexible. A temporary solution is better than permanent confusion. If you can make permanent a bad definition, all the risk is on state and local government. All the risk is on the funding of government agencies and government groups who, by law, actually have to balance budgets. So dollars out means those are dollars that have to be replaced. And then finally, do no harm. It was never intended to, the moratorium was never intended to reach out to states and take money away. As a matter of fact, it was a placeholder in 1998, grant clause was put in place to preserve taxes that were already in place and said from this point forward, for 2 years, we're going to impose this moratorium. There is a different way besides just making permanent a bad bill and a bad definition. Senators Parker and Alexander have introduced legislation on the House side, on the Senate side, that reflects several of these principles. Limit the definition, let's say what we mean, let's make it temporary, extend it for 4 years, let's maintain the grandfather clause, which is an important protection for state and local government. At the end of the day, this debate does not have to be, and by the way, I always love the names, because the other side of this issue, I represent states, which means tax collectors. Okay, no better tax collectors, I get it, even why. But we don't get the benefits of don't tax our web. You guys got the bumper sticker, we know. However, this is not a bumper sticker issue. You don't have to be for the web or against it. As a matter of fact, a reasonable extension, you can be for state and local government and for the internet. You can do both at the same time. And that's the compromise of the middle ground that we're trying to find.
Thanks, David. I'm glad to know that everyone here at the table is in favor of the internet, because honestly, that really is the first point that was actually on my little card here. I wanted to share 4 points on this. The first one being that we at eBay think that the internet is actually a pretty good thing, and it's been working pretty well. Based on that, we would say it would be a mistake to change sort of any of the fundamental underpinnings of how the internet works, including the tax-free nature of access. We think that the internet tax moratorium has been something that has helped propel the internet to grow. We think that this is a positive. And so point number one is really, if there's going to be a position in favor of the internet, we actually think it's to maintain this tax-free nature. And we would say, because it's really very fundamental, the idea of giving people access to this powerful, empowering technology, we would say that having that access not be taxed by states and localities permanently would be a good thing. So, first of all, the internet's working. Let's keep the fundamentals going forward. Number two is, in particular, kind of ironic that we're debating this issue now because, you know, my friends from the states and the counties have a tough fact, I think, in their perspective, which is that state and local tax revenues are better or not. I mean, that's just a fact. Go to the Census Bureau, look up state taxes, and you'll see that the states have never had revenues up to the level that they have today. So in particular, the debate about making sure that the states can tax more, I think, is kind of ironic at a time when state and local budgets have never been more healthy. Number three is the fact that the internet, unlike most, we think, technologies and services, really is, as I said, a fundamental empowering technology. It's really key to the 21st century economy to be able to have access to the internet and all of the services that are available over the internet. And in particular, all the services we believe that will be available over the internet in the future. And as we both said, I'm the first one here to say this is about internet access taxes. It's not about taxes being applied in any way to various services over the internet or products that one might purchase over the internet. That those are governed by other legal regimes, and we can come back for another one of these about any of those legal regimes if you'd like to talk about that too. But the important thing is that the internet really in the future is going to be key to advancement. advancements in the health field, advancements in distance education, advancements in telework. You know, many of the companies in California these days are spending a lot of time talking about the environment and global warming and what can companies do to help deal with that issue. And honestly, the internet, just as a core technology of allowing people to do things at a distance, really is key to addressing that. So we want to advance that, but we want to slow that down. And then lastly, from a Canadian perspective, we think that the internet has been key to allowing individuals and small businesses be able to fully participate in the 21st century economy. For the first time, honestly, small businesses, Main Street storefronts, and little towns around America are for the first time able to compete with the Walmarts of the world, at least by having access to a global customer base. They don't have access to the kind of sourcing and transportation that Walmart or Best Buy does, but in terms of reaching customers anywhere in the world, they can actually do that. And so if you're a small business who sews fly fishing lures up in northern New York, for the first time you can sell them to fly fishermen anywhere in the world. And that is the power of the internet, and that is something that we think we don't want to make it more expensive for that person to do that. If anything, we want to hope that the prices would need to go down in terms of access to the internet because of all the economic, social, and honestly, free speech sort of snapshots that we get from that. So, thanks for your time.
Well, stuff to last on a panel like this. I want to bring on a few folks. Again, Jeff Arnold from the National Association of Counties, who is also here representing the League of Cities and the Conference of Mayors. They've been honored to speak on their behalf. So it's really all the municipal boards out there that kind of feel the same way. I want to be really clear, and it's important for you to keep in mind that no one wants to tax internet access. Prior to 1998, there were only 9 states that imposed any sort of tax on the internet access. During the one-year lapse between the time that the first 98 Act and then the final 2004 Act went through, no one imposed, not a state or local level, imposed any tax on internet access. I haven't been talking to a municipal or county official in this country that has ever suggested that they want to tax internet access. I'm sure there aren't too many governors out there who would like to go out and say we want to tax the internet. So first of all, I think it's a political reality that we're in a very difficult position to suggest that we want to go out there and tax the internet. We certainly don't want to tax email. That one of the big debate things we hear on the floor all the time, the local government wants to tax email or IM or all sorts of things. That's nonsense. We have no interest in doing that whatsoever for small people. It's a logistical nightmare. But beyond all that, it's just nonsense. When you hear those sorts of big hearted things, I think you need to just reject them out of hand. You know, we're really partners in this game. When it comes to governance in this country, you have to keep in mind that the people I represent the same people you represent. I think that's an important consideration. The House and Senate sometimes forgets that we actually are government too, and we have to provide the services at the local level. All of you live in a city or a county, unless you're from Connecticut, they don't have counties in the same way that the rest of the country does. But the bottom line is that you all live in some form of municipal government, and you have to keep in mind that we're providing those services. There are many tax limitations in states around the country, which has limited local government's ability to raise revenue. And subsequently, the idea of federal government stepping in and limiting our ability to choose what's right for our communities in terms of tax policy really separates the people who have to tax and the services that are out there delivered on a regular basis. Constituents don't want services. There's only one way to pay for those. It's really critical to note that David did mention that the Internet of 2007 is simply not the Internet of 1998, and that definition that he referred to, I really would ask you to go back and actually look at it because you'll laugh. It's so comical in the 2007 era of what the internet was thought of back then that you'll understand it once you compare that to what the equivalent of S-1453, which is the Herbert-Alexander bill. I think you'll see quite a different thing. The way we access the internet, I mean, I'll bet you there are a whole bunch of Blackberries in the room. How many people thought just 3 or 4 years ago that you'd have a browser on your hip all the time? Probably not. So we don't know what's going to happen down the road, and we think that a reasonably extended moratorium where you can come back and visit, see what the technology is, makes a lot of sense. We've given up on, there are some white papers out there suggesting that we're for no moratorium. That's simply not the case. I think we realize that the internet continues to grow, and we want it to, and we want the competition out there. It's important to keep that in mind. That we'd like to see more platforms out there having access to the internet because of that. More competition brings prices down, and we're all for that.
Well, thank you, guys. My promise to these guys, as you know, from the background, I haven't been in
I was going to be unbiased until both David and Jonathan take a shot at that fabulous work we did in 1998, right? The definition of internet access in the definition of 98. Even my 26-year-old brilliance hasn't helped for me. All right, we're going to question time. I'm going to give you a little bit of a break. I have several questions up here that the panel actually submitted to me to ask back to various panels. But if there are questions in the audience, I'll start there. If not, I'll just warm up with a couple questions. You know, how many of you have questions? Okay. Congress, under the Commerce Clause, has the power and has used the power under the moratorium to impose a moratorium on states. So Congress has the power. The question really, though, from a 10th Amendment standpoint is, at what point is enough enough? And we have this battle all the time from a governor's standpoint, the states, states versus the federal government. Where exactly does the line end? For 200-plus years, Congress, when it came to state local revenue systems, really draw the line and say, you know what, a core part of sovereignty for states has got to be the revenue systems, ability to collect and pay for those public services that they provide. Only in recent years has that line started to become blurred, and the moratorium is one of those examples of Congress wanting to reach out and actually use state local finances to cover a national issue. Address a national problem. It's our stance that really, when it comes to revenue systems, we have to draw the line and say, you know what, if you're going to cross that line, and Congress has the power to cross the line, the 10th Amendment in our federalist system says, you better be precise, you better know what the consequences are, and you better do it in a way that really respects the states. And part of our problem with the definition as it's currently written is that all the risk of an expanding scope and an expanding nature there and all the excitement falls on state and local government. That was not the intent. And therefore, if you want to get back to the intent of our federal system, Congress needs to be precise and only agree with revenue systems when it's absolutely necessary, better be very careful when it doesn't. So it's not necessarily a Supreme Court case, but it is the system we have to do.
Well, I can just say one thing that I think the concept that should be kept in mind is the interstate commerce authority of Congress, you know, to regulate that. And the fact that we would look at the internet as fundamentally sort of an interstate commerce type of service. The ability of Congress to regulate that, in particular, because, you know, we've talked about internet access, but, you know, the issue of discriminatory internet taxes is part of this. And some folks wonder, what would those be? Well, the fact is that there are oftentimes local service providers or product makers who do not like competition in the form of sort of interstate, distant competition. And an example might be if someone were to receive their news over the internet as opposed to receiving a physical newspaper, that the folks who sort of locally print up the paper might very well like to see a higher level of taxes on essentially the same kind of service coming over the internet from out of state. Certainly, local and state government would be far more responsive to that local interest than it would be to the distant interest. And that's where the federal government's authority to regulate interstate commerce is really key. So part of this is that the internet, we believe, is sort of uniquely very much of an interstate commerce type of service.
How do we blurred the line, though? I think it's important to keep in mind what we're talking about here is internet access, not the goods and services that flow over that access. I think that's a fundamentally important.
Yeah. No, no. I mean, it is also multiple discriminatory taxes. We're most clearly not talking about, for example, sales taxes. Sales tax collection burdens being imposed on remote sellers. But the moratorium does cover when there would be a different tax, let's say, for a download than there would be for a physical equivalent. That would be covered by this moratorium, and that would be an example of, in particular, an interstate service competing with a locally provided product where you could have discriminatory taxation that would be sort of the kind of local or state levels in the playing field really would be distorted in favor of the local and state provider, which from our perspective would be why it's the Congress who has the authority to regulate interstate commerce, including interstate taxes.
So let me throw in a moment of prerogative here. And correct me, guys, if I'm going wrong at all on this. I was actually going to ask, so I'm going to ask a softball question for my week. No one has spoken over any comments about the multiple and discriminatory prong of the internet tax moratorium. There are two prongs. Actually, fairly straightforward. Obviously, we've got traditional debates that include a little bit of pressure for no multiple and discriminatory taxes, no internet tax on internet access. I'm going to ask, do we all agree? Since it wasn't addressed in most discriminatory taxes, that's not really part of the ongoing debate related to access and definitions of access and those kind of things. Since I've been doing this, we've never talked about it. Those are going to continue with an extension of our time. I'm going to challenge them changed. Are you for making those permanent?
I'll make your name a permanent.
I just wanted to make clear because it does get a little confusing. I just want to make sure everyone was on board. I think you were all saying the same thing. That's just what I wanted to clarify for the crowd. It sounds like no one is intending that we somehow should be saying there should be discriminatory taxation. We're really focused on the other problem on internet access. I just want to make sure that's what Brian was addressing more eloquently than I have.
We have the states and counties saying that they don't want to tax internet access. We have them say that they don't want to tax in a discriminatory way.
You're putting words in my mouth.
Well, no, I'm saying you have said, yeah, but I'd love you to say it, that you don't want to tax, for example, iTunes downloads different than you would tax the same equivalent product provided locally.
Well, that's our discussion, however, it's been virtually impossible to do. It's hypothetical without reality. How would you do that? It's ludicrous. We have to keep in mind, I would sit here, I'm a former Senate staffer, I come up with all sorts of weird stuff. All the time. The reality is we have to focus on what's real, but how does that taxing process works? Bottom line is there's no way the local government is going to do discriminatory taxes on internet access. It's just simply not going to happen. We might have to make it permanent. We don't need to make it permanent right now. We need to figure out where the internet is headed.
No. Multiple
taxes. I don't think you need to make any of them permanent at this point.
I know you said that, but why not?
Not necessary.
There's something confusing about multiple discriminatory taxes.
No, it's not clear. It's just not necessary at this point. That's a perfect metaphor.
Which is also a good place to go back to the question. Back to you. I need to restate the questions that we get on tape. So if I go wrong when I do these questions, make sure to correct me. I think if I summarize your question, it is, shouldn't we be putting equal or more focus on finding ways to make sure that everyone has a PC, which then to, Charlie has Apple there, with a PC so they can get on the internet, and the internet tax to be done to be quite as important as maybe providing that kind of hardware for people.
Well, I think that's a good question. I think it still is important, though, if you're looking at a PC, how much would the access cost? If we were talking about free access to the internet for everyone, then I'm sure my friends would say local governments would disagree with that. So the two go hand in hand, but just because you have a PC doesn't mean you're going to buy broadband or high-speed internet access.
I mean, if you guys want free access for free, then you should be happy with it.
But I mean, your question's a good one. This is the broadband issue. Like, with this issue, it's really complex. It sounds simple on its face, but everybody turns around, this is about broadband penetration. And I'm trying to deflect the fact that there's both a GAO study and a University of Tennessee study that looked at
those grandfather states who still tax versus everyone else, and found that, you know what, there's no statistical link between taxing access and broadband penetration. If you really look at it, you're absolutely right. It's more about, do you have a computer versus what is there attack on the internet when it comes to broadband penetration. We got to get down to what's really important and what's an issue. One of the reasons that the engineers come out and say, let's be specific and take these key points, it is, let's get through all the fluffery, the, oh, you're going to kill the net, or, oh, you're going to kill broadband, because, again, every governor's for all that. But let's solve the problem at hand. Let's update the 1998 definition. Because of even distributed direct taxation, no single government group has ever said those are problems or stop or discontinue them. Let's carry them through. It's all part of one bill, and I know we can address. I'm actually very happy that everybody here said this is going to be about access. And at the end of the day, that's exactly what we have to do. Let's define access, and let's make it clear as to what that means. I think that's really the purpose of where we should be heading.
Two questions. First one, really, because I think I know your answers. How much the program be extended? And secondly, how should the definitions be changed?
Why don't we start with this? Well, we have essentially endorsed the Carbonelli standard, which is a 4-year extension of the moratorium to answer that question. And I think that's all of the cities and counties fall in that category. And what we're trying to do with the definition clearly is that what we have is a shotgun approach. We have a bunch of pellets out there, and what we're trying to print in those definitions, we're pulling out individual exceptions. What we're trying to do is try to narrow that down to what really internet access is, so that we're more of a rifle shot, and that we don't have to have exceptions out there to try to get at the various different types of technologies. We want to make sure that we understand exactly what internet access is.
You may support the permanent extension, and we believe that actually in the definition of access, I mean, if there are tweaks to the definition that you can make, there's no effort, I don't think, by anybody in the coalition, the No Tax and Web Coalition, who wants to in any way try to go beyond the current situation where it is, where it covers access. There have been discussions about entities trying to bundle video or bundle phone services into access and gaining some kind of tax advantage. I don't think there's any actual concrete examples of anybody trying to do that. That's certainly not. I don't think the intent of our coalition is not to do that. So, you know, the question of having a good definition, you know, I think there would actually be progress if we all agreed to make a good definition of access and then make it permanent. Yes, that's the goal of our coalition as well. So,
NGA is also part of the Carbonelli standard bill. It's 4 years. For all of you here, let's be app insiders, if you're going to extend a moratorium and do it on a temporary basis, better to do it in an off-election year. So even years, if you think through it, will probably make a lot more sense. And that's not me saying that. That's what we've heard from others. It makes a lot of sense. So the four years seems like a reasonable time period to move forward. Temporary is an important safeguard on this bill. You know, it has been. It was a part of the balance out of respect for state and local government. However, until you know what it is that you're talking about, temporary is also a safeguard against abuse, both on the state and local side and on the business side. It keeps everybody honest. Again, it's heartening to hear that we should address the definition. And with the issue of the definition back in 1998, the definition made perfect sense. Thank you. All of you have to draft a bill or legal counsel here. When you have to define something that you don't know how to define, what do? You define everything, and then you accept things out. And that's how you try to get down to this world that you try to define that's never existed before. Fair enough. That makes a lot of sense in 1998. All we're saying is we now have to reverse that. We have a much better sense. We all have agreement with access. So let's define access. And that way you don't risk putting a lot of other things into that grand definition that no one ever anticipated. And at the end of the day, what we want to make make sure that just because something is provided over the internet doesn't mean that that determines its taxability. Access is subject to a moratorium. Everything else is in the state, local, and federal tax law, just like it always has been.
Okay. Person on this panel actually worked in the Legislative Council's office. I drafted legislation for 6 years and I wrote a lot of the Family Medical Leave Act and the 1986 immigration law. So I have a lot of experience with definitions that people argue and litigate over whether or not they are clear or unclear. But this notion that we have to make this law temporary because the definition of internet access is unclear is not in the face of every piece of legislation that's written up here. Why should we not make every piece of legislation up here sunset? Why not make every complicated law only temporary? Seems to me, I don't think you can point to any situation in which any of the companies or associations that are part of our coalition have been abusing the law since 1998 to look for ways to not to not pay taxes or not collect taxes. I have no situation on that you've all been referred to one. So it seems to me the burden should be on your states and your counties to demonstrate that we have been seeking to abuse the law. In fact, the opposite has happened. State and local governments, contrary to what you said, Jeff, have been looking for ways to tax internet access. Without question. When T-Mobile buys internet access from a backbone company like AT&T, right? Some state and local jurisdictions have been taxing that transaction, even though it seems abundantly clear that Congress did not want any taxes to be imposed on any internet access at all, whether it's a wholesale transport transaction like that or retail. So we have not been the ones, and we're seeking a permit. We're seeking a permit moratorium. We're the ones who've had to deal with a lot of abuse from state and local governments.
First of all, abuse is an interesting term. I get abused sometimes with the simplest things like driving on the morning. The reality is that we're really gets to an important point, and that's what is internet access? So what level in the chain does internet access go back to you? Are you not allowed to do anything with the backbone itself? Does this moratorium go all the way back to the head end? It's an important question, and that's why the definition really needs to be crystal clear. Because otherwise, we could have debates about this all day long as to what is or isn't subject to taxation. And I don't think Congress was as clear as they thought they were being back in 1998. And I think what we really need to do is get back to what David suggested, which is let's get the right definition that we want to have in those discussions of what might be taxed or not taxed at the local level or anywhere else. Thanks, Mike.
So the question is specifically about the grandfather clauses, the clause whether it should be kept in or out going forward. I guess under your various bias, so change the definition, but as a temporary or as a permanent. Certainly, the position of our coalition is that the grandfathers should end at state local governments that were grandfathered have had ample opportunity to get used to permanent moratorium to adjust their revenue expectations. And we certainly shouldn't have an equal situation that we have now where in some states they tax internet access and other states they don't.
I always enjoy it when some industry decide that it is up to them to decide how state and local officials should spend their money. The grandfathers was an important safeguard. It was a placeholder. It was, if you've taxed it up to now, you can continue to tax it because that's fair. Do no harm principle, but from here forward, we're going to say no. As a temporary moratorium, that's an important balancing act that should be maintained. We're talking about $120 to $150 million that those states currently collect. Doesn't sound like much up here in Capitol Hill, it's around here, but in state local government, that's a big deal. That's a lot of money. I think a lot of folks in those states who care very much for the revenue that's there. However, there's also a second point. Again, this goes back to the way this whole bill was constructed. The grandfather clause also grandfathered all taxes to that point. Everybody thinks it's just tax on access, but all taxes.
taxes, direct and indirect. And part of modernizing this legislation, and as we move forward, part of the discussion has been what exactly is a tax on internet access? Is a business tax on an ISP? Is that a tax on internet access? Is a tax on the ISP? Or should ISPs just be completely tax-free? You have to get all those things right under a permanent moratorium. You have to know exactly what taxes are subject and what taxes aren't. I think it's as important to business as it is to states, because business will argue that states will get really creative and they'll find a new fee or a new way around it if we lock this in. States will say, wait a minute, why are you telling us that you're making an entire tax freeze over and going up on the internet? Because that's not what we meant. And so the preservation of the grandfather is actually important for those two reasons. First, to those states who already collect, do no harm. But second, in addressing this legal issue of exactly what taxes do apply. And both of those would have to be answered before you can really do anything with with regard to these taxes. One more quick point. And that is, I also always enjoy the argument that state and local governments are rolling the money, and therefore we can pass tax moratoriums and the federal government should decide how to spend that. Governments have to submit and pass balanced budgets. Dollars in, dollars out. That is a real restriction on state and local government. This is not a for-profit entity that governors are running here. And so just because states are doing well now, they don't always do well. Taxes have had, as a matter of fact, revenues are flattening out. But at the end of the day, who should make decisions about state and local tax revenues? State and local officials or federal officials? That again, surprise, surprise, the Governors Association says that should be made with state and local officials.
Just in the context of having David saying that nobody really wants to tax internet access, nobody wants to have any discriminatory taxes, but then you're going to go up with the defense of state that tax internet access, so clearly somebody wants to. And also the fact that he's concerned that there may be other taxes where they would want to apply to different internet delivered services. I think in that context, our view is that the grandfathers ought to be ended as this is made permanent. That's the reason why it is very relevant, I think, for Congress to look at the revenue situation in the states in the context of this issue is because in a year going from 2005 to 2006, when state revenues increased, again, these aren't our numbers, this is the Census Bureau who collects this stuff, state revenues increased $59 billion. So that was the growth in revenue from $647 billion to $706 billion. So $59 billion increase. You mentioned that this internet, the grandfather clauses, states, those nine states, that their total revenue from these internet taxes were $115 million. Our view would be that now would actually be the absolute right time, as state revenues are increasing last year over 9%, that addressing this anomaly related to internet access taxes would be the right time to do it, because it really is a rounding error. That is a rounding error in the size of congressional budgets, but more relevantly, this is a rounding error in terms of state tax revenues. And if one supports tax for internet access, then at least unless you agree, we all agreed that was a good thing, then that would be the right time to end the grandfather clause that allows that disparity.
There's no left throwing numbers around when you start talking about it. You have to look at those individual nine states, see what situation they are, see what other opportunities they have for replacement taxes. It's not just the high, big number. There's, whatever the numbers are in there. That's not really relevant. You have to look at those nine states, see what the revenue situation is, see what those state allows them to come with other revenues, and I think that's more relevant.
Do either of you know of any state that's a grandfather state and lower revenue in 2006 and 2005?
When talking about lower revenue, I'm talking about replacement.
Do you know anyone with lower revenue? Did any state, as a grandfather state, actually have lower revenue? So the revenue base is growing tremendously. Because the economy is doing well in part because of the strength of the internet. But if none of them are losing revenue, I mean, that's I think, a relevant point.
It's not your money, it's not. And I don't think all the states are doing that. Well, we actually have some states whose revenues are actually getting
paid. You don't think the grandfather states that have falling revenue?
I don't care. I don't know. Let me know. good topic for you guys to touch on, but if there are any other questions, because I don't want to miss it, a lot of you raised it in your question, and that's just kind of bundling. Can you guys just address that topic a little bit from what the issue is? You probably mentioned it in your opening comments, and then what the resolution of that should be, and then we'll work backwards. Jeff, you want to go first? So.
The proposal we have on bundling, I think we worked out a fairly decent compromise.
Sorry, Matt, would you be so kind as to give about a 15-second
aggravation to those terms?
Yeah,
exactly. One of the idea is of providing internet access, phone, cable, and as you've probably all seen the ads on TV, but everyone doing that now, that's kind of the thing. So the idea being is that if there are taxes, you would not tax, let's use the Comcast example, just because it's running all over the place, for 33 for your phone, your cable, and your internet access. $66 of that could be taxed. The $33 of internet access would not be taxed. The idea being that that we would be actually getting at that. The bundling language basically says, and if you do that, it's a responsibility of the company to separate those out so that it's clear which is phone, which is cable, which is or video, I should say. And with internet access, if for some reason the company is unable to do that, the entire amount would be subject to whatever taxes were imposed. And that was, I think the compromise that we worked out, it's worked out pretty well.
Right. Yeah, we think it's worked out well. I mean, as Broderick mentioned, we don't believe there are any examples where companies have tried to sort of abuse that accounting principle that was created to try to avoid anybody trying to call something access that was not access. I don't think it's that wrong.
The bundling provision was an excellent ad. The issue, however, is you have to have a definition that allows you to actually separate them. If the definition allows you to put everything under internet access, and then you have to unbundle internet access from everything else, it's meaningless. So again, when you get back to the definition, you have to get that right. Because it's been temporary, I'd argue that that's really one of the reasons that this hasn't been abused. Because if you have a permanent bill, it makes a lot more sense to take the legal path and see what needs to go through to get a tax advantage. But when they're temporary, everyone keeps everything much more honest. If it's not a problem, then we can change the definition and we won't have this issue next time around.
And if we get the definition of internet access right, you all agree to a permanent moratorium?
No.
You never will. I mean, we'll never get the definition right, as far as you all are concerned. When you finally get it right, I think this actually works better than you would have expected, right? Well, I think it works pretty well. But I want to come back to common sense again. When you file your tax return as an individual, if you take liberty to violate federal tax laws and regulations by filing a report, that's shady here or it goes to great lengths there to try to abuse the tax code or find loopholes, you're exposed. Same thing with our companies, right? So we have great exposure if we were to abuse any loopholes we perceive in current law. And we just don't have an incentive to do that, so. To address the question of one, is there any proof of less uptake because of taxing internet access? And secondly, is there any economic argument for why internet should be exempt from internet access should be exempt from taxes when say phone or cable IS or any other communications device might be taxed? Well, I guess point to the GAO study and the University of Tennessee study is proof of the notion that it doesn't matter whether there are any tax on internet access as to adoption rate. So you'll hear that. I guess I have to say that when you look at statistics that show that for people who earn less than $30,000 a year, their adoption of internet access or high-speed internet access or DSL or anything else is
is substantially lower than people who make more than $30,000 a year. That seems to be a pretty compelling common sense argument.
Elasticity of take up rate versus tax.
You know, it's because of price. It's because of cost. There's no question that I had to go back to the earlier question. Does the cost of computers impact internet access? Almost certainly yes. I mean, cost, I think, is a general rule. I think we would think that, especially at eBay, where it's really a market based kind of system, is that at higher prices lead to lower demand. For everything. And so since taxes would potentially become something that would drive the price up of internet access, we would believe that without question, the general free market economic rule is you can have less demand if you have higher prices. And in the telecommunications space, you actually have some very, very high marginal tax rates. You have taxes in the range of 25% of some different kinds of telecommunications service. The reason why we believe internet access was made tax-free was because at the time the internet was just beginning, a number of folks up here, honestly, in the Congress said, this looks like it's extraordinarily promising fundamental technology for economic growth. Do we want to allow potentially bad legacy tax regimes that apply to things like phones or cell phones be locked over onto the internet and therefore slow the adoption of the internet based on high taxes? Because of the fact that Congress has acted over a couple different times to say no, we think that's one of the reasons why the internet has grown well. We think that the overall economy has been well served. We would say turning that back and now potentially moving in the direction of high legacy tax rates and applying that to the internet would, simply by driving up prices, make a slower evolution. We think that at a time when the internet is doing so much good for the economy, that to make it more expensive to access it would be a negative thing.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love the buzzwords, high legacy tax rates. High is a relative term, and I think if you go back and look at it, it does vary dramatically around the country. There are some that arguably, as we said, are probably too high, but the reality is that it's not our goal to take those legacy tax rates and throw them over on the internet. It's just not something we're planning on doing. It's not something that I have any local members ever said they would have. A related question to the one before, tangential, but what does an increase in price or an increase in taxes, I guess, what does that do vis-a-vis understanding and delivering for broadband, especially with the global view?
I certainly understand where you're coming from. However, I would note that we're 15th during the era of the moratorium. So I would say that there's no relevance at all in respecting up to it.
Disagree.
Yes, sir.
with another elasticity question I stated from the opposite direction. And I guess that's just for them to maintain the taxes. It don't matter if it's a product that's relatively cheap. I mean, that's what, isn't that sort of where you're going with that? Is it, does it make any difference? Yeah, well, but everyone can't do that. I mean, a lot of people who can't just sort of go. And besides that, there are folks who want to be on the internet at any given point. They don't have to, if they decide they want to adopt it in their own homes, that they then load up the car and go over
But if you're a small business person, let's say you want to operate in part over the internet for your small business, then having sort of $5 dial-up or having really the basic AT&T DSL, which I think is at that rate for 2 years because of the Bell cell phone, it's not a secret, but those are not something that they're planning to move on. The fact is to have a more robust internet connection. Again, we look at the future 5 years from now, maybe a small business person is trying to sell things over the internet. We want to have video to sort of show their products and things. You know, that could be a $70, $80 internet access bill at higher speeds. And, again, I understand that our friends from the states and localities say they really don't want to tax this thing, but they really just want to retain the ability to tax it if they really want to. Okay, and there are other kinds of telecommunication services where the rates do run up in the 25% range that, taking internet access from $80 to $100, that would be a meaningful tax increase. And again, we would look at it from the other side and say that we should be weighing the many benefits to the economy, the society, to the sort of public discourse, to have more access to the internet. And then we would want to raise the cost of that even a dollar with the tax revenue, that the tax revenue benefits are not nearly as beneficial as greater access to this new technology, this very powerful, empowering technology.
Yeah, that's one of those things I like that argument, except the fact that, how are you paying for police, fire, schools?
$760, 10% revenue increase last year. As you said, the tax on revenue is just marginal.
At the local government level, we may not be as robust. I'll just tell you, it's a really tough road to hoe. Every nickel that we bring in tax goes right directly back out to the citizens of this country. You've got to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I think the point that these are among the most repressive taxes and fees. When the city of Baltimore, for example, wanted to balance its budget a couple of years ago, it added a $3 or $3.50 tax to every cell phone. And it didn't matter how much the income of the people, of course, was that they taxed. And that was an easy way to collect revenue. They did it. And it seems to me it wasn't fair, even though I'm a product of that city.
It's always nice to be able to say, I don't like a tax. It's regressive. Sales taxes are regressive. There's a lot of regressive taxes. You don't like them, go out. And when the facts are on your side, I think the economic questions were actually right on point. Because you're going to ask, what are we trying to do here? And are we doing it? And when you don't have the facts, you come back, the old adage, are your facts if you have the facts, and if you don't pound on the table, you get pounded on the table. The regressive, it's a tax. They have the money to afford this. Hopefully get the money, governments have the money to also help with healthcare and schools and a lot of other things. But at the end of the day, again, who's absorbing whose revenues are these? And ultimately, this is a state and local tax issue, and those decisions should be made at that level. Better than guys and everybody else is calling for a reasonable extension and modernizing the definition of internet access. Let's do a reasonable extension. Let's do no harm to state and local government, but let's go ahead and extend this thing. And the problem I always have with this debate is it always gets to where it has become, and that is they're against the net. Not all the facts. You use fear. Well, I think everybody needs to take a step back and see what's being offered and say, wait a minute, there's a different way forward and a better way forward and get policy perspective and move forward. And I think, again, I want to go back to the Carper Alexander. We can address a couple of very good points that we can actually agree on and move this ball forward. And then we can be back here for this once again 4 years from now, if we could.
Two more questions on this. We've done accidentally, obviously, then they were good questions. But we've done three investigative economic questions in a row. If there are other points out there, I want you to make them. And while we do, I need two more questions. I'm not going to give you guys a chance to do closing statements. So that's the trade-off. I'll have many guys here, and they're going to be real sad in the future. I'll have questions.
A question directly to the appellants. Obviously, the guys get thrown in here, but specifically, given there seems to be some agreement that the internet's been good for everybody, and in fact, I suspect you guys have already been really good for local government and state government, in that light, why would you not be for a permanent moratorium?
The flexibility aspect of it is the most important thing. The permanency locks you into, even if we have a great definition, the internet could change. We don't know. The internet is not, before years ago, not the internet today. It's a safeguard. It's an opportunity for us to be able to come back and revisit. It's not saying we wouldn't continue after that, but it's an opportunity to come back and revisit and see if we're in the same place we are today.
I echo that. The temporary was an important safeguard and one of those balances. And again, I know I keep harping on this, but this is federal power versus, you know, state authority. And you know, going all the way back to the Commerce Clause, just because Congress has the power doesn't mean it should use it necessarily. It should address problems, not create solutions for things that aren't necessarily there. Making a bad definition permanent will actually make everything worse, both for state and local government, and quite frankly, it could be for the internet as well. You can create tax differentials between competitors. It can actually be anti-competitive moving forward. We need to make sure we get this right.
Make it permanent doesn't mean it can never be amended. If there are these the fears that you all have could always be addressed. At some point, they could be addressed in a year.
Well, you can address them next time, or you have to renew this time. That's a good one. Oh, it's a good one. We can amend it. You all know how broad our congressional standards here, how hard it is to amend a permanent bill. And remember, on the amended access board, on the only one with oversight over this thing is Congress. And then come back every 4 years and take a look and say, let's check and see where we're at. Makes a lot of sense, especially when you are talking about limiting the authority of state and local government. Last question, Harry.
So I'm trying to put this into a question. So the question is, let me paraphrase, there are still urgencies in what the charter falls at the local level. The flexibility to tax the internet seems like one way for the localities to raise revenues. Why is that not making a good idea because localities need revenue?
I just said that I think that, again, at some points in this discussion, there seems to be unanimity that nobody wants to actually tax the internet. Your question is, when state, when localities in particular really face revenue challenges, shouldn't they be able to tax the internet? I think that what the question really points out is that, absent a moratorium, despite all the rhetoric to the contrary, we're going to see taxes on the internet. That exactly driven, and we see this in many different ways, but there's no question that there are very important things that state and local governments do. And absent the moratorium, we think in many cases there will be taxes very quickly imposed on internet access or discriminatory taxes against businesses that use the internet. And for exactly the reason that you point out, I know everybody said that they believe
used for emergency services and others. But it just points out the fact that we're not flush in cash. We don't want us to tax the internet access, certainly not. There are other ways to possibly get some services over the internet that we might be looking to impose sales taxes on. That's another debate. But the reality is that counties are really hurting out there, and we're not rolling them.
Mark did. Just I think your question really is, who should be making the decisions when it comes to revenues? I mean, state and local governments have different priorities. You know, they have different states, all the different counties and cities. Thank you. The all with unique needs. And we're going to make them. Every time that the federal government comes in and says, guess what, you cannot do this, it harms or adjusts their ability to handle exactly the situation. I'm not saying they're going to go out and tax internet access. I am saying that every time that the federal government decides that it's going to make the decision on how state and local tax dollars are spent, that it hinders the ability of those state and local jurisdictions to make the decisions and provide the services they need to provide.
Well, the decision is not about how the revenue will be spent. It's not about the federal government jumping in and deciding whether or not you should spend more money on roads, more money. That's not what this is made about.
So whether or not, in the interest of national policy, to get broadband deployed ubiquitously, whether or not we should make sure we maintain a moratorium on taxing just internet access, just the ability to get online and then to engage in commerce or knowledge. That's really what it comes down to. I think that debate and that issue has been settled. And this should be our national policy.
12-year advocate in me has been just dying to get by, trying to keep us all under control.
I think I did not already have
any part of control. But I don't believe it. Can we all agree that if the internet tax moratorium were to go forward however we think best, that Congress's approval ratings would probably go through the roof?
Yes.
I think the answer is yes.
That's a high bar.
As you can tell, we have a very well-knowledge, very distinguished